we get it rolling like we always do this afternoon and every Tuesday by talking with our friend Colin Fleming.
You turn the sunshine into rain. Baby, for a thrill, you gave my heart nothing but pain.
It is, as you know, Black History Month, and Colin thought it would be great this week to talk about three perhaps overlooked, very talented artists, starting with that one, Lil Hardin, who has quite an incredible musical background. I have to confess, I didn't know a lot about her, but I do now, having read more and more. Colin, as always, thanks for joining us and bringing these artists some attention that they certainly deserve.
Oh, no problem. Can you hear me okay? Bit of a departure field trip today. We are in plein air in shorts down by the harbor with our avian friends.
I like it. You sound
your
great.
Animals just, okay.
I'm hearing the ambient sounds of nature. I like that.
Oh, yeah. And there's a rabbit all agog. He's presumably a Kimball fan. But yes, Lil Hardin, who essentially got Louis Armstrong's career into gear. He sort of fawned over King Oliver, and she was already an accomplished musician. She was a very talented pianist, and she was in Chicago before Louis got there doing her thing. And when Louis hit town from New Orleans, basically he was the one who was able to get Lil Hardin to go out with him. No one else could really do that, plane overhead. And she was crucial to, I think, some of the most important music ever produced in this country. Perhaps the most important music ever produced in this country. And that would be the Hot Fives that Armstrong cut in 1925 or so.
Yeah, and you mentioned she remade his career in many ways, even in terms of his physical appearance, helping to tailor him to reach a broader audience.
Sure, he had bangs, which was a no-no at the time in the big city of Chicago, and he was kind of seen as a rube. He was not deemed urban enough, basically. He could play, well, as a cornet at the time, like no one else could. I mean, we're talking a level of virtuosity that Paganini on the violin, something like that, Vítislav Richter on the piano, Hendrix maybe on the guitar, Charlie Parker on alto, but like that kind of level. So he always had the chops, but she basically marshaled his ability into something, a force with greater focus. And she was paramount in those recordings with that group. When you have Kid Ory on trombone, Johnny Dodd, a marvelous player on clarinet, Johnny St. Cyr, and Lil Armstrong. They would rehearse at Armstrong in Lil's apartment in Chicago. Can you even imagine, like, you're in the next room? Right? You're in the next apartment over here across the hall. You're like, oh, we are so doing some pasta tonight. And you hear that because think about this. It's not like a band playing jazz across the hall is going to be like soft. Like, they're going to be rocking in that apartment. And if you could bootleg that, right? Imagine? Wow.
And influenced so many people, and her songs have continued to be listened to for generations, versions by everybody from Ray Charles to even Ringo Starr.
Yeah, strutting with some barbecue. I mean, she was legitimately like could hold her own with, and this was a time for jazz when it's really a sort of modernism. It's going past that sort of original Dixieland jazz band stuff, and it's as modernistic as James Joyce, really, in a way. And she certainly played at such a high level, but she was amazingly versatile too. And she basically, after she parted from Louis, she became a swing musician. Now, that might not sound like too much, but between like sort of chamber music, small band jazz, and swing music, and Louis made the switch as well, but he was also arguably the most gifted player in the history of the medium. She wasn't that, but when you play that clip at the beginning, you hear that kind of glassy, communicative timbre of her singing. It's almost sort of like a slightly flatter version of Billie Holiday. And that piano is just so wonderfully percussive, the way it accentuates her voice.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown as we celebrate Black History Month. Let's switch artists and instruments as well and give a listen to a guitarist who influenced people like Eric Clapton, Mike Bloomfield, and countless others.
Well, I can't quit you, baby. But I gotta put you down for a while. Stuck my happy home, baby. You made me mistreat my only child.
Little West Side Chicago blues there, Colin, from Otis Rush.
This is one bad mother, basically. When you play the start of that clip, there are three things happening there, and I don't know which is the most impressive. You have that feral vocal introduction, right? It basically sounds like Howlin' Wolf, but minus the wolf graveliness, right? Almost like instead of gravel, we have something sourced from Lake Michigan, right? From nighttime, that kind of like dark bottom side soil underwater. And then you have that chord come crashing in, which is so fantastically loud. You can hear in that recording from Cobra Records that the studio was not equipped to handle blues at that volume. And then it's like, okay, well, that's enough. He comes in with that guitar lick, and that lick is so physical. You can basically feel it in your solar plexus, like, oh, wow. It knocks you back a little bit.
And he's a left-hander, too.
He just basically flipped the guitar upside down, a la Hendrix, and sort of cupped his pinky finger underneath one of the strings that gives it, again, this sort of percussive effect. And there's really no one who sounds like Otis Rush. I don't know if he was a better singer or guitar player, but you hear how he sort of pits the guitar lines against his voice, and that works just like wonderfully well. He's working out of the jump blues tradition of T-Bone Walker. And T-Bone Walker was kind of a bridge between swing and Chicago blues. It was a shuffly, jumpy sort of music, but here there is more percussive force in the beat. We're veering almost towards rhythm and blues. And the sides that Rush cut for Cobra Records in the late 50s, they're up there with Muddy Waters, Robert Johnson, the few recordings he made, Charlie Patton. I mean, really, dozen or so shortlist blues recordings.
And is that the best place to start as an introduction to Otis Rush with those Cobra recordings?
It really is. Yeah, they've come out on compilations over the years. There aren't tons of them. I mean, you're basically getting one record's worth. Well, I guess one CD's worth now. Back in the day, it probably would have been like a double LP. But yeah, you're getting like less than a couple dozen cuts, a couple outtakes, and you're hearing that very powerful vibrato that there's just certain players, you can hear a bar of them on their instrument, and you know instantly who it is. Art Tatum, for instance. Now, some of those players aren't, like, hugely virtuosic. You hear, like, a snippet of Lennon's rhythm guitar, and you're like, oh, well, it's the Beatles doing their thing. But Otis Rush was like that, and I've never heard Zeppelin ripped him off quite a bit. I've never heard anyone come close to emoting on the guitar through his material with the same power he had. He cut some sides for Chess Records after Cobra went belly up, and they formed, like, a half album with Albert King that's really good. You go through his live recordings over the years. You go through, he was kind of a label journeyman. You're never going to find anything where you're going to think, well, he just didn't have it on this day. He mailed it in. You are always getting more than any money you put forward with anything Otis Rush did.
We're talking with Colin Fleming, and let's listen to another artist, a guy who had a lot of hits in the early days of rock, rhythm, and blues, whose life and career cut short much through his own doing. But let's listen to a song that you may think was recorded first by Peggy Lee, but oh no, this is Little Willie John.
You never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. I get a feeling that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning, fever all through the night.
To me, Colin, what's most impressive about that is that he was 18 when he recorded that.
Do you hear the horn-like enormity of the voice?
Mm.
It doesn't sound like something that comes from sort of the human chest, does it? It sounds like a bunch of horns locked in unison. So like when the band swells up near the end of that clip you just played, it's still Little Willie John's voice. He's a little dude, as you would expect, that rises above it. And everyone knows the more famous version of that song. I'm going to say that Little Willie John, I don't know that I've ever heard anyone sing better in American popular music. He had so much ability that when you hear these songs of his, like Need Your Love So Bad, Suffering with the Blues, they are some of the most painful pieces of music we have. And yet he's able to sort of transcend pain, and they sound almost palliative, like just the enormity of his spirit and of his voice. He was incredibly hot-tempered, and he may have been, he sort of alluded to a few of his transgressions, sort of his own doing. He may have been a pimp. he basically gets in a fight, and allegedly self-defense, but he knifes someone. He goes to Walla Walla, and James Brown visits him, and Little Willie John, kind of like Orange is the New Black, like the soul version, says that he doesn't imagine himself getting out. James Brown cut a trip. An album, a tribute for him, and true, he did not get out. He basically, if you've ever heard the Beatles outtake, Leave My Kitten Alone, that's Little Willie John.
And are his recordings hard to find?
No, there are like three sets that you can get. You want him on the King label, which is what he started out with in like 1955, and that's sort of his classic material. Lots of covers from the American Songbook near the end, but he had like this furlough basically from jail where he gets out for like a little bit, and he was going to have this big comeback, but in like 1966, which we don't really associate with like Little Willie John's time period, and he's working with a producer who does him no favors, and you have these very odd arrangements married to Little Willie John's impeccable vocals. So, no, you kind of want to avoid that. But the King material, again, all of it is just, it's the invention of soul, basically.
Mm.
Again, we have the blues, always with Little Willie John, but we see the blues splintering. The blues is the great American musical art form. People will tell you it's jazz, but really, jazz is based on the blues. So here with these artists, we get the progression from jazz to jump blues to what is becoming soul. But it's really soul blues. So, again, blues underpins it all.
Member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Well, you know you got to be good when James Brown used to open for him.
Right. James Brown was a lot of things. He was, I think of him foremost as an arranger of huge, almost geologically sized pieces of sound. He could layer rhythm and pit rhythm against rhythm, but he couldn't sing like Little Willie John. And so it always, to me, when the Beatles were doing Beatles for Sale and they needed another cover, they had kind of run out of gas after A Hard Day's Night, and the fact that they were going to take on Little Willie John's Leave My Kitten Alone is, in a sense, kind of hubristic, because you're not going to do well with that. But then Lennon pulls it off. And if you wanted like an indication of how much confidence John Lennon actually had as a singer for all of his poo-pooing of his own vocal ability, you'd look at something like that. Now, they up the tempo that kind of helps Lennon out. But Little Willie John is just an unbeatable singer.
Great stuff. As we celebrate Black History Month with three terrific artists, find out more about them. Listen to their music. Lil Hardin, Otis Rush, and Little Willie John. Colin, we thank you. So how warm is it in Boston that you're out in shorts?
You know, I'm in the Red Sox shorts outside, my nighttime uniform, and I'm feeling pretty warm. These rabbits have come out in spades, and it'll probably go back to like 17 degrees tomorrow because it's New England, but it's a little odd, really. Unnatural order, quite Shakespearean.
Well, it's supposed to be in the 60s here tomorrow, so I'm going home tonight and look for a decent pair of shorts to strut around in.
Hey, don't get overconfident, my pneumonia-ridden friend.
Not a chance. Thanks, Colin. We'll see you next week.
All right. I'll see you.
Colin Fleming, every Tuesday here on Downtown.